Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 110th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The URLs for the previous 109 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13.com. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and that would be the 183rd column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll also find links to my daily newspaper at my web home. It's free. It's one email a day. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. But I'm excited about the upcoming series of shows starting next week of Cthulhu Lucian K. Truxot IV. So I hope the audience for this show will catch the upcoming one as well. Then now to this show, the 110th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is poet, novelist, singer, songwriter, and college professor. Boy, that's a lot. Susanna Rich. I first met Susanna, assuming that met is the correct word in our virtual life, on Facebook a few years ago. I was extremely impressed by her accomplishments to begin with. But a recent surprise when I found out that although born in the United States, she only spoke Hungarian until she entered grammar school. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Thank you, John. I'm delighted to be invited, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I'm really interested in you not learning English until grammar school. I worked with a lawyer once, the son of Italian immigrants whose parents spoke broken English, but did not wish him to speak that way and refrained from exposing him to English until he, like you, entered the Catholic grammar school. Did your mother or grandmother speak English?
Well, my whole family were fleeing from Hungary. This was right after the communist invasion of Hungary, and So they had to escape. My father had started a newspaper called Hungaria, which was very subversive, and his life was threatened. So my mother and my father landed in New York. They came by boat, of course, and soon after that, my grandmother came. My grandmother is the one who actually raised me. My mother and my father separated pretty quickly after I was born. Lots of trials for the immigrants and lots of losses. So my grandmother is the one who stayed at home with me, and my mother was out making a living for us. And my father was always involved in my life, but he was always separate. So yes, my grandmother called Mumchi, that was her nickname, is the one who attended to me, and I am so grateful that she's the one who was my primary caretaker. She was talented and vibrant and loving, and it is in her lap where I learned how to sing, and she also created a Hungarian newsletter called Szórakoztató, which means entertainer. And we, in our bedroom that my grandmother and my mother and I shared, we had a mimeograph machine. And I don't know if you remember this, John, but remember when we had those blue mimeograph sheets?
Oh, sure.
And we had an old typewriter, and it always made holes, and we had this wonderful, wonderfully smelling gel, blew out, let's call it that, when we made mistakes. And we would run those newsletters off. And so my first language and my first reading was in Hungarian. And so I did not learn how to speak English until I was five, when I went to kindergarten.
I've read that Hungarian is like no other language, and that and the other Manhattan Project scientists at Los Alamos during World War II referred to John von Neumann, Leo Szilágyi, and Edward Teller as Martians because they were so smart and their language was incomprehensible. As a student of languages, is it true that Hungarian is so unique?
Hungarian is very unique. It is not one of the Indo-European languages, and it is not one of the Germanic languages. And they say that they put it into a group with Finnish and Estonian as a language group. But I tell you, I'm Hungarian, and I know the Hungarian language. And Finnish and Estonian do not sound anything like Hungarian to me. They should have called it the miscellaneous pile. But Hungarian is very different, and in some very, very significant ways. I'm delighted that I was wired, so to speak, if I can invoke Chomsky, in a different language, because it very much has affected my life as a writer. I don't know if you want me to go into comparing Hungarian and English and why that's significant. Shall I do some of that?
Okay.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. I went to Hungary in 2005 for 3 months on a Fulbright. I was very, very grateful for that organization. They do amazing work around the world for peace and for education and the arts and the sciences. But in any case, so I went over there, and yes, I'm fluent in Hungarian, and Hungarians love it when somebody comes from America and is fluent in Hungarian. And so, you know, I was able to navigate everywhere and anywhere, you know, because I could always, you know, ask questions in Hungarian. Well, my cousin, some of my cousins I didn't know I had and who I found when I was there, said, oh, yes, you don't have any accent, you speak so very clearly, but we know you're American. And I said, well, how do you know? Are you talking about my genes? And they said, no. My one cousin, very astute, very smart, all of them are, but she's, Emirka said, it's your stress patterns. And that opened up a whole world for me. I started to research the difference between Hungarian and English stress patterns. And then that led to analogizing to differences in American and English culture American and English and Hungarian culture. And so what the difference is this, in English, our predominant stress patterns are the iambed, right? It's like the heartbeat, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And also the anapest, which is da-da-bum, da-da-bum. It's always upward tending and always gaining energy. That's the rhythm patterns for English. Hungarian has the diametrically opposed stress patterns. So for them, it's ba-ba, ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. So it's always losing energy. You always have to hit that first syllable. So I was speaking Hungarian with American stress patterns.
So, and she picked it right up.
Yes, and it was wonderful. And then I read this one. I read around, and it works on so many different levels. In Hungary, everything is the opposite from the American or the English-speaking world. You know how we flip a switch upwards to turn it on? In Hungary, we turn it downwards. In America, at least, the sirens all go upwards. In Hungary, they go downwards. And then it gets even more profound. We have common law, so that we have in America and in England, we have a case, a case, a case, a case, and then we create a law, you know, following the patterns that we see. In Hungary, it's downward tending, which means a law is made and then the cases are subsumed to it. Education tends to be inductive in this country. It tends to be deductive. So this whole opposite pattern of gaining energy for the English-speaking word, ba-boom, ba-boom, and the opposite for Hungarian, bum-bum, bum-bum, goes through everything. It's as Wittgenstein said, imagine a language and you imagine a way of life. And so it's so, and when you think about Hungary never has won a war. England and America have been the imperial powers on this planet for how long? So it's a really interesting study that was led to, that, you know, came out of my looking at. And then what got really scary, John, was that I looked at my poetry, and I write in English, but my patterns tend to be predominantly trochees and dactyls, all that downward tending Hungarian rhythm. So it's scary.
Really? No wonder they call the Martians, right? They didn't understand any of that.
We do. Hungarians are the opposite.
as a very young child, you had experience, as you mentioned, both in publishing and in performing. Please tell us about that. You got into piano early. You did the publishing work early.
Well, that was, I mean, what I saw was how my grandmother was typing and how devoted and energetic she was about it, and she would illustrate her newsletter, and so I was her chief assistant. You know, I ran the mimeograph machine, and I got to put the goop on the mistakes, and also I got to use colored pencils to color in the covers, and I still have some of those covers framed. It's quite a treasure to me. I knew that my father was a newspaper man. So very early on, you know, I started to identify with these very significant people in my life, in terms of writing. And then my grandmother was also a show person. She, I remember one specifically, she was doing, a program in which she was enacting the incarcerations that the Hungarians suffered during the Second World War and afterwards, and so she dressed up in a prisoner outfit that she actually sewed, you know, with the horizontal stripes, and then she transformed herself into the Statue of Liberty with a lamé costume. So she was quite wonderful. Very early on, I had a taste for writing and for performance.
When you finally went off to grammar school, there must have been a real culture shock as you were thrown in with children who not only had very different childhood experiences, but spoke a different language. What do you remember about that?
Well, it was very traumatic because everything was different from the way they were and the way I was. But the worst part, and a lot of kids, you know, go through this, but I went through this in my own special way, was the food that I was taking to school. I mean, my grandmother would buy these uncut loaves of rye bread and hold them against her ample breast, and, you know, she would take the knife and she would cut the bread, and it was always scary because she used the knife towards herself, you know, when she was cutting the bread. But anyhow, I would get slabs of irregularly cut rye bread with salami and green peppers and pickles, and, you know, and the other kids got the, and, you know, I mean, that was a hefty, smelly, wonderful lunch, but not for a five-year-old, where everybody else has these dainty peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with fragrant Concord grape jelly in it. And I felt very, very odd. And, you know, I probably smelled of garlic. I didn't know how to be. I mean, I was also an only child mostly, and so I didn't have social skills of how to be with kids. I remember particularly when I was given flashcards with words on them, and, you know, pushing it away in a peak of frustration. And I remember this one particular thing. You know how they have a picture and then they have a word, and, you know, the kid is supposed to know, well, that's a faucet. Well, I didn't know the word faucet. In Hungarian, it's chup. but I remember that particular word being a trauma to me. As most kids do, I picked up English fairly quickly, and I must say that I did develop a lot of friendships. My father, my whole family, Hungarians tend to be fairly outgoing, not everybody, of course, and like to party. So somehow or other, I found my way, and I still have friendships from kindergarten. It's quite wonderful, but it was hard. It was hard, hard to be different.
By the time you were in high school, you were starring in theater productions, and you were doing well enough in school to begin to track toward a PhD. You were obviously an overachiever, but you mentioned in the note to me that Hungarians tend to be overachievers, as if that could erase a national disgrace of never winning the war. Could you expand on that a little?
Well, again, we have one of the greatest wounds that Hungarians have sustained in the past 100 years is the Trianon, the Treaty of Trianon at Versailles, where two-thirds of Hungary's landmass and two-thirds of the population were distributed to the surrounding countries. So two-thirds of Romania now used to be Hungary. And it was a terrible, terrible blow. Personally, my grandfather, on my mother's side, they couldn't speak Hungarian. They couldn't get educated in Hungarian. It's apocryphal that he walked from Bucharest to Budapest, and he had to leave behind a lover who would not marry him once that political came into the fore. So it was very, very hard on the whole country. I feel that this happened as a the overachieving happened so that they could overcompensate for it, and I mean there's a lot of books that Hungarians have of all the famous Hungarians who made it in the world, and there's a lot of bragging about it and in the worst case scenario, it becomes kind of a chauvinistic thing. But I totally understand it. So overachieving is often a sign of not feeling like I'm enough. And so I have to make it because there's a family shame, there's a survivor guilt for all the people who couldn't make it in the culture.
I know that you wrote a collection of essays entitled Still Hungry, in which you explore how your thousand-year-old heritage affects your daily life. Now, what stage of your life did you write that? Would you go into that feeling a little for us?
One of the ones of which I feel the most proud is something that got published in Nimrod, and it was called My Trianon. And so, I feel that my starting to write really happened when I was working on that newsletter with my grandmother. But in terms of writing it down in English in a traditional way, that was around 2003, where I really settled in to write this collection. And to explore, how my life is still hungry. I may be talking in English rhythms, but my poetry is still, that great unconscious that we writers are the shepherds and the harvesters of, still wired in Hungarian and in those rhythms. So that's when I really feel like I started to work on those. And I hearken back to when I was at the piano. My grandmother wanted desperately for me to be a concert pianist, and so she my father's best friend was a world class pianist, and she said she was fond of telling me that the way he got to be Julian Carollo got to be a famous pianist was that his mother beat him to the piano with the broom, and so she was very rough on me, pushing me to get to the piano. I never became a concert pianist. I think I just had to save myself. But what I do remember is that very young I started to compose melodies, and that's what I've picked up in the past couple of years to become a songwriter, which is very satisfying.
A young lady who started off wanting to be a concert pianist was Condi Rice, until she realized she wouldn't be world class at it, and then she went to political science. After high school, she was off to college in to North Carolina for master's, NYU for PhD. Tell us about those years, the experiences, why you chose that study line, and what you saw as your life going after you finished.
Well, for me it was always I started out as an English major in college, partly because of the wonderful experience I had in high school when I was cast as Anne in The Diary of Anne Frank. That was a really life changing experience, and partly hearkening back to being the only really competent English speaker in my family, you know. So I was teaching my grandmother how to speak English fairly early on, you know, after I got to school and got proficient in getting around in English. So I believe that was what got me into taking on English as a field of study. I was a theater minor when I was at Montclair State, but my young life was very, very unsettled because of my mother and father's divorce, and you know, I also developed some step families, and you know, I became kind of a scapegoat for their miseries. I mean, these were all immigrants who, you know, came from a country they couldn't go back to, you know, political problems and, you know, fleeing through forests and, you know, hunger and pain. And so, you know, they didn't have, and the step families didn't have energy for a child of a previous marriage. So, I decided I was too fragile, and I had not a good sense of boundaries, which is ironic, which is because it's a kind of a metaphor for how hungry and having such shifting boundaries. But I didn't have good boundaries, and so something in me said I can't go into theater at this point, because I was really afraid that I would lose what little sense of myself that I had. And so I decided that I wanted to find my anchor in myself through intellectual work and through artistic work that didn't require being with theater people.
Sam, stop. That's happened 2 weeks in a row that he made that mistake.
Oh, I heard that. Well, you know, it's a little breather.
Okay.
So So I decided that I wasn't going to go into theater, and I fell in with some sociologists, and I fell in with some philosophers, and I really loved the exercise of my mind, and they were fairly benign people in those departments, and so I pursued a degree in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a wonderful, wonderful school. I was really, really lucky to have Paul Ziff take me on as his assistant. I was pretty feisty in a class of his, and I was constantly challenging him, and he loved that. I didn't know he was going to love it. But his specialty was philosophy of language and art. So, you know, I have never strayed from the love of language and the love of art, but at that time I was looking at it from an artist, from a philosophical perspective. And then I came back to New Jersey, and I got married, and I wanted to pursue a life as a writer, but again, I um, I was too shaky to not have some external structure to support me. So I went back to NYU and I took a degree in communication, specializing in the teaching of writing. And I am so glad I did that, because my teaching career has been a source of joy and energy and insight and tremendous amount of love between me and my students, and they for each other in my classes, which is very gratifying when they get to know each other because of the work we do. So during that time, I was bouncing back and forth, as many of us do, between, you know, making a living, finding work that helps me to feel steady in myself, which is what the teaching has done, and still very much longing to be doing the creative writing. And so I went back to school at Warren Wilson in the writing of poetry, and then halfway through I said, what am I doing? I've already written a PhD. I think it's time to go home and write. And
speaking of the PhD, please take us a little into your doctoral dissertation.
Oh, okay. Thank you for asking. That was fascinating. Mitchell Ayoska, who was an extraordinary Virginia Woolf scholar, and in subsequent years, I've been teaching graduate courses on Woolf and the Bloomsbury Group. But in any case, he said to me, "Well, Susanna," I told him that I had written a novel, and during that time between things, I had written a novel from the point of view of Cinderella's stepmother, obviously, because I was trying to understand my own stepmother's difficulties, and I was trying to find a way to be about her. And so he says, "Susanna, you've written this novel. You know, why don't you write a creative dissertation about it?" And I said, "Okay, but you know, I still want to maintain focus on some intellectual traditions." And so what I decided to do was to take a look at the I wrote a lot of journals during the writing of that novel. And so I took a look at those journals. I was also undergoing therapy, and I had notes from that, and I had the drafts of the novel. I knew what was going on. So I decided that I would look at the different theories of what makes the creative process, especially for writers. So I did that. That was the intellectual foundation for the dissertation, to look at different ways to interpret what the creative process was for me, and to look how different critical approaches will yield different insights into what happened in the writing of that novel. So it was a very, very satisfying piece of work to do. And I used Norman Holland's Dynamics of Literary Response. Oh, he's a Freudian, and that was part of what I explored.
How difficult was the defense of that?
Well, again, Mitchell Ayoska and my chair, Carl Schmidt, and my third, Robert Landy, they all recommended that I do this, because they felt that it was a resource for the field to have me writing from that perspective, because there were few people who were able to have that capacity and also the philosophical underpinnings. It was the writing of that dissertation was joy to joy to joy to insight. It was an extraordinarily satisfying writing project, and it went very quickly. I got my degree in 2.5 years, including the dissertation. And the defense was wonderful, except that at one point I'm a gesticulator, and I was making a point, and I tipped over a glass of water and went flying across the the table. But my chair was very fatherly, and he came over and mopped it up, and it, I think that was a baptism. it was a wonderful experience. I'm grateful to my teachers and for their guidance.
I know just how did you feel at a dinner one night with two other couples on October three glasses of cappuccino on the table.
I don't understand about the first one, but the second and the third I do.
You've been teaching at the King University for a number of years. What do you teach, and how has your methodology evolved over the years?
Oh, I so adore teaching. My methodology, I have become more and more authentic, and my number one understanding is that my students don't learn what I say as much as they learn how I am and who I am. I learned that because I created a course. I don't know what kind of chutzpah I have. I guess it's part of the good part of being Hungarian. I created a graduate course on teaching of college writing, and my first chair, Carol Schaefer Kuros, and a former chair, Bernie Weinstein, and a lot of my colleagues, my senior colleagues, came to take that course, which is a credit to them. But anyhow, so I taught this course, you know, fresh out of NYU and, you know, full of chutzpah. And so I asked them at the end, well, what worked best for you? What did you appreciate? And I said, oh, yeah, now lay it on. I was fishing for compliments. I said, oh, just lay it on. Oh, yes, we love this. You did that. You did. Oh, and your punctuation routine was so original. Well, you know what they said? That the single thing that meant the most to them, and they did like the other stuff, but the single thing that meant the most to them was my passion for writing and for the teaching of writing. And you see, that I can't put on. And that's and so I know that with all of my students, what they're learning is who I am. And so it's a sacred trust to me that I keep myself alive as a writer and a reader, and that because that's what they're going to learn. And many of my students come with a lot of fear, this sense that literary interpretation and creative writing, you know, there's some way that you have to get it right, and I as the teacher have that, and you know, I'm the anointed one, and they're just the peons. And all of my teaching is to show them that they already have all the capacities for interpreting creatively and fully and passionately and with joy. And that's the way I teach. And so for me, every class is a class of discovery. I do not come in thinking I have to make sure that they get this interpretation about the scene between Antony and Cleopatra, that they have to get that interpretation. I come in, you know, I show them different skills. I'm just talking about my Shakespeare survey course, for example. And you know, it's a class of discovery. And I ask them, well, which scene meant the most to you? And I let them guide the discussion in that way. And then we take off. And it's all about giving them tools that they can apply themselves. And I tell them, if I don't learn something new in a class session, then that was not a good class session. If I learned something new, that means they had space to be creative and original, and we discovered something together. So it's
you also started the blog in relation to this, because I can teach, which is that because I can teach, all one word, .blogspot.com. Tell us something about the blog.
Well, that came from teaching as well. Again, I can't have my students do something unless I am not a hypocrite. I'm doing it too, and so, you know, all this, you know, our students are all getting these curved necks and cramped and crippled thumbs from constantly texting and looking at their phones, and so I instituted what I call a media freeze. And that means that they are to take a particular day or a particular period of time, choose a medium that they are compulsively addicted, to which they are compulsively addicted, and freeze. And don't use that media for that period of time. And so and it is very, very successful. That particular blog has a lot of great comments on it from them. And so I said, oh, yeah, sure, Susanna. Well, who is spending 15 hours a week on Words with Friends? I was really, really addicted to that Scrabble game. And so I said, well, if I'm telling my students to do a media freeze, and I better go for it. And so I said goodbye to all my friends there on Words with Friends, and I shut the thing down, and I erased the app. I deleted the app. And for two hours I was like, you know, it was scary because it's like being an alcoholic and not having that drink. But the drink is right in front of me. And so within 2 hours, I decided that I'm not going to waste 15 hours of my week doing Scrabble. And then I said, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start a blog. And so I sat down and I wrote my first blog post, which was called The Media Freeze. And so that's how the blog got started, because I had to do, I can't ask my students to do something that I'm not also doing. And it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. The blog is, that to me is a profound thing, you know, the medium. I had one of my students who's a chef, and he's also a writer. And what he decided to do is he decided to not use a microwave.
Wow.
For a weekend. And I allow them to be very creative with what medium they know is their addiction. And so he didn't, and he said, and he had to bake, he had to plan ahead, he had to bake his potato in the oven, and it was a whole different, and what he said is he was able to slow down and feel more deeply his passion and love for cooking, and you know, and how that patience makes a difference in the cooking process and in how food tastes and how nourishing it becomes. So, I mean, it's that, and I've had students say, I realized who my friends really were. I mean, some people got off texting for a day. One student misunderstood the assignment, and she got off all media, her computer, her phone, her television, everything for a week, and her life was completely transformed. You know, she was able to mend things with her family. She got involved with some stuff at her church that she had wanted to do but couldn't do. So it's great, and that's just one blog. So it goes like that. It's inspired by what happens in class, or something that I'm working on. So it's great. It's fun.
One of the awards that you won that came involved your first book. Would you tell us about the book?
The book is called The Flexible Writer, and Alan and Blake Bacon brought out 4 editions of it and the instructor's manual, and that was a wonderful experience as well. One of my colleagues was Joe Opiella is at Allen and Bacon still, but he was going around to schools. His parents live near Elizabeth, and so he came, and a colleague of mine sent him over to me, and I told him some ideas I had for writing a textbook that allows students to understand better their styles of thinking and to use a writing process model that's not linear but allows for different styles. And so he signed me in 3 weeks. I sent him a proposal in 3 weeks. He signed me in 3 weeks. It took me 22 months to write the first edition. And so I call it my elephant because that's how long an elephant gestates. There is a unique, I developed what I believe is unique to the field, a model that's recursive, and it's a circle with instead of, first you have to do this, then you have to do that. Any of us who write knows that it's never that neat. You have to actually build in. If I'm really going to be successful at writing, I have to build in opportunities to make mistakes so I can get creative. So the model allows for that, and it went through 4 editions. So that was exciting. And
now you called this your first book, but you mentioned earlier that you already written the novel. Did you publish the novel?
No, the novel did not get published. I have another novel that I wrote the year after my father died. I have not pursued publication venues for it, so I've been focusing mostly on my poetry, and that I'm grateful for all the publications I've gotten for poetry. So the novel that I wrote about my father really draws on my Hungarian roots, I will pursue to have it published sometime when I have time.
In 2001, you began a radio program of poets on the publishing your own poetry before that, and tell us about the radio show.
The radio show is called Poets on Air, and we had I had a yoga teacher who had a radio program, and she invited me to do some segments. And so one of the first segments that we did were with wonderful poet Joe Weil, and we did a program, The Best Poems of the 20th Century. we had a wonderful time with that, including a rendition of Green Eggs and Ham together. And then I also had a colleague who was a Jesuit priest. We did a program on the Psalms. That was very different and also brought a lot of good responses. The most important segment that we did was on the first anniversary of 9/11. And again, I am so very grateful to colleagues. I was able to, at that time, it was Billy Collins was a poet laureate or had just finished being, and he was on the program, and Stephen Dunn, Alicia Ostreicher, and so we had Charles Beeler, and we had many poets reading from their poems. Dennis Nersky, Carol Stone, Charlotte Mandel, and that's a segment that we put up on the website. So we did a number, and I also interviewed B.J. Ward, and featuring him. I was supposed to get funding, and then something happened at our college, and a lot of funding went away for the arts, and I turned my attention towards working on a series of poems in response to the Holocaust. And after I had written 20 of the poems, I actually remembered that I had portrayed Anne Frank in high school. I had completely, taken that out of the forefront of my consciousness. And that was a really profound project to partake in.
You mentioned that the 9/11 show is up on
yes.
the web. What is the site for that?
It's poetsonair.com.org. So we have both of those. Poets on Air. We also have a Facebook page for it. And I'm very, very taken up with teaching and with writing poetry and getting books published and my theater company for a poetry show. So that program is dormant, although the segments we have are posted.
Okay. Then in 2008 you began this performance. Let me go back to the poetry again.
Yeah.
Had you been publishing your own poetry before Poets on the Air?
Part of what I'm coping with now is trying to not try to please everyone and be good at every at too many things. And so what happened is because I was so focused on teaching and the textbook, I did not send out poetry. In 2007, I had a mere 35 poems published. And it was in 2007 that I was able to turn my attention to I had gotten all my promotions, and I was able to start saying, what do I really want to do? And it always comes back to writing, always, always comes back to writing. And so I was invited to the Warren County Poetry Festival, and that I think of as my reintroduction, or perhaps my introduction into the world of poetry. And I was so pleased and honored to be invited. And so I decided that I wanted to read my poetry, recite my poetry by heart, because I had seen Philip Dacey do that at the Passaic County Community College readings. And so I memorized all of my poems, and I did them by heart. And that, I feel, was the beginning of my coming out as a poet. And that was September of 2007. And then I said, you know, I really, really love this work of presenting the poetry without the podium in between, and really being able to look at people and to embody the words. And so I asked Ernest Wiggins, who is a professor at King University, and who also got a Kennedy Center Award for directing. He's really superb. And I asked if he would help direct me in my readings. And I thought it was just going to be something, he's just going to tell me to, you know, use my vowels more roundly and, you know, do this with my hands or whatever. But no, what he did, our first meeting, is all of a sudden, there he is in my office, and he has brought three students with him. And I realized that what he had in mind was he was going to make a production. And so I went with it. And then we had some theater space. And, I took the poems that I have a series of poems where subsumed under the title of Television Daddy, in which television and the father figures on television are woven throughout the poem. So it's very cohesive, and he helped me to arrange them, and I wrote some new poems for the show to help the pacing for it. But, you know, we would be in the theater space, and he would say, okay, Susanna, this poem you're going to do for the floor. Get down on the floor. And he just had me do all sorts of stuff, and he also had such a gift. He said, Susanna, we should do this with audience interaction. What can the audience do? How can you get them involved? You know, how are you going to bring them into this? And so I said, okay, we'll do that. and so we opened Television Daddy in March of 2008. And it was an exhilarating experience to put this show together. And here I was, able to, you know, bring back my love of theater and you know, being much stronger now, you know, having a career, having worked through a lot of stuff in myself so I can hold on to myself and to be able to and to realize some of the theatrical talents that my grandmother had instilled in me and encouraged in me when I was little.
Now, you actually incorporated the production company, Wild Nights Production, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Well, we opened another show 2 years later, The Drive Home, and then the Ashes, Ashes, which is the Holocaust program, you know, where I take on 15 different roles, and I have poems from different points of view towards the Holocaust, including a skinhead and, you know, a grandmother who has to suffocate her child. Right after that, I said, it's time to incorporate this into a company. And so, yes, we have Wild Nights Productions, and the title comes from Emily Dickinson's poem, Wild Nights. And we incorporate it so that we have a website so that people can look for the shows, because, you know, part of doing this is to, you know, let people know it's possible and, you know, to go out into the world and, you know, give the show legs so that we can reach out to many different venues. So so that's when, yeah, I incorporated that, and we have our website for it. So, yeah, it's...
And it's Wild Nights, N-I-G-H-T-S, productions.com?
Yes, W-I-L-D-N-I-G-H-T-S, P-R-O-D-U-C, P-I-O-N-S.com.
Would you like to raise something for us now?
Oh, sure. That would be great. One of my happiest moments was when Craig Linville asked me to do write poetry for his baseball documentary Cobb Field, and the way he found me was through this poem that was published in a wonderful baseball literary magazine called Spitball, and it's one of my favorite poems to read and to perform. And for those of you who love baseball, you will get all the baseball terms. I don't know if I fully understand them, but I absolutely love the discourse and the glossary of baseball. And so here we go. It's called Squeeze Play. All night the Mets and Rockies foul balls into the bleachers, and I find myself wanting them to tip one my way, slip it like a coin into my blue plastic commemorative baseball cap ice cream cup. For I know now what I didn't before. 40 years, God help me, since I failed to memorize who was on which base, being traded for what so that Don Giordano would love me. 38 years since Kenny Texa pitched me a line about going to a guy's only game, breaking his promise to teach me instead how to park. Well, never mind. I never was the kind of girl who actually liked watching men waving their sticks, cheered them, fingering their balls, stared at their diamond for all it was worth. Only fast girls, I told myself, let boys get to first, and then second, and then, well, it was safer to be a shortstop widow than a bleacher bride. But tonight, you steered me to my box seat, and pressed your Carvel and peanuts into my hands, grateful for my coming, and I scored myself a wonderful wife. No longer a girl struck out. I'm begging for hits, suffering over flies. Give me a triple header tonight for all those years. A game of 27 innings. I love this study in anticipation, this festival of comets, this reprieve from a life without bases, this you becoming a boy again, and me, a girl who catches it all to line drive us home.
Very interesting. Very good. You won the many awards for you won the prize for your the poem in response to the Holocaust memorial.
Yeah.
You were nominated for an Emmy, as you just mentioned. You had the Fulbright. You won the prize for your essay Lullaby that was from your original essays. Tell something about these.
About Lullaby?
The various awards.
Oh, the various awards. Ah, okay. So this poem was the poem, the Squeeze Play, I'll start with that, that Craig Linville found, and he commissioned me to write poems for his baseball documentary, Cobb Field, which was about an old field in Billings, Montana, and we go through the day from the morning while the uniforms are being put into the washer and dryer, all the way to the end of the day through the game and so forth. And so it was a very fascinating process because he gave me the finished film, and I had to write poems to the particular sections he wanted using those images, and to pace it so that I can read it exactly into that space of time. It was much harder and much more exhilarating than writing a villanelle, because it's nice to have forms to work within sometimes. And so we were nominated for the writing of that documentary. We were nominated for an Emmy, and I was very, very proud and grateful for that. The poem for which I won the Ekphrasis prize was called Shoes on the Danube Promenade. And that's in response to a Holocaust memorial in Budapest. They were the Arrow Cross, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the fascists had lined up in during the Second World War. They had lined up the Jews along the edge of the Danube River and facing towards the river, and they shot them into the back. And they were all linked together with chains so that they would all pull each other down. And the river turned, you know, into blood. And so the Holocaust Memorial that was installed in 2005 are a series of cast iron shoes for different, you know, for women, for men, for children, lining the edge of the Danube. So I won the Ekphrasis Prize for that poem. And the lullaby is an essay that I wrote about my grandmother sitting me down at the piano, and she was pretty rough on me, and so I weave the words of the Brahms lullaby with the notes in there. So it was kind of an interesting technical thing I did in there, and that won the Fugue Prize for a nonfiction essay.
What was behind the Fulbright?
Oh, the Fulbright? Well, that was in 2005, and I applied to the organization asking to go to Hungary because I wanted to continue to write my essays on, about being the child of Hungarian immigrants. And that was also extraordinary. Kamon Magyar, who is an entrepreneur who brings many acts from Hungary to the United States and is an amazing cultural ambassador, he and his wife, Judith, he gave me a recommendation. And I actually got a double award at that time. It was the Fulbright Fellowship and also a Collegium Budapest Fellowship, where I was given housing in the Raoul Wallenberg House in Buda, so that I could do the work, and that led to not only further essays for Still Hungry, but a collection of poetry called Nuns Flying Through Walls, which I'm, you know, currently sending out. So that was quite profound, and we spent, my husband came with me, and we spent 3 months in Budapest and Hungary. One of the highlights of that time was I went down to Kalocsa because I love Hungarian embroidery, especially the Kalocsa embroidery, which is extraordinary bursts of flowers, predominantly poppies and forget-me-nots and tulips. And I had five women sewing for me for 6 weeks a traditional costume, including seven petticoats and a corrugated skirt with perhaps 1,000 pleats and a vest deeply embroidered and an apron and so forth. So that was one of the great highlights to have that happen. And I remember when I went down to have them, put it on me for the first time, I realized that this is something that we don't have as much in this time of ready-made clothing. Perhaps if a mother goes in with a teenage daughter in a Marshall's fitting room, there's some of this. But it was such an amazing event for me to stand there and to have these women build this costume around me. I really felt how sacred it is. How dressing is a sacred thing. I mean that in a non-sectarian way, in a universal way, and that is something that we're missing. And it was just an awe-inspiring experience. And I take this costume around you know, I am also a folk dancer, an international folk dancer, and I take this costume around and I let my colleagues build the costume around me, the seven petticoats, the corrugated skirt, the apron, the blouse, and so forth, and the headdress. So many, many experiences like that with the Fulbright, and great organization, very generous.
Didn't the event that our audience hasn't yet gotten the magnitude of your work, I point out there were approximately 750 publication and presentation credits to date.
Yes, yes.
In much of your writing, you've dealt with your own heritage. There is presently much discussion and confusion, as well as a good deal of hostility today about the extremely large Hispanic immigration to the United States, and
yes,
even the larger of Syrian migration into Europe. What are your thoughts on these issues?
Well, I am with all of these issues, I try to look at both sides and to understand and not to blame and not to demonize. But I'll tell you, I have to say that I am very ashamed of how Hungary has been treating the Syrian refugees and the walls that they put up. And whereas I still understand it, I'm ashamed of it. America is the land of opportunity. I am absolutely grateful that I was born here, because I am convinced that I would not be alive today if my parents had stayed in Hungary. I might not even have been born. And so I think it's really important to have a dialogue and to not demonize and not label. There are things that we can do as a country to knock off this corrosive, evil, bipartisan battling, and start paying attention to what's going on with human beings and have a dialogue. You know, for Donald Trump to you know, just offhand call the Mexican immigrants rapists was just totally unconscionable, and I'm ashamed of that too as a country. I know that we have to be careful with the boundaries, but we can also have a human dialogue and provide. If we spent less money on wars and on and less time and money on bipartisan battling, we'd get a lot more. We'd have a lot more resources to be able to welcome people and to learn from them and to exercise and to develop our humanity. Because that's, you know, I guess you got me started. what we're doing to this planet is unconscionable ecologically. But, yes.
I'm not sure that we spend enough time thinking of the courage of some of these people. Like my four grandparents of the fleeing island came on these coffin ships as a little more than teenagers, not knowing where they were going or anything. Your parents ran away from terrible stuff, but having no knowledge of what they were going to find in this strange country, these Guatemalans and everything, send their kids by themselves, these 10 and 12-year-old kids, hoping that they'll find some place that they won't be murdered. I mean, we tend to lose that when we grew up here of not remembering, what came before us. Now you're closer to it than I am, obviously, but I think that it's the tendency of the people once they get here to want to pull the ladders up and to lock the doors, you know, and I think that's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. Yes. There's the Statue of Liberty.
What's next for Susanna Rich?
Well, I just published, I just had one wonderful Greg Brown, publisher and editor of Blast Press, just brought out my book, Surfing for Jesus. And it's not searching, it's surfing, like, you know, Surfing USA. And in there I explore the interface between religion and commerce, especially in this country. And we also just released our first CD for the musical that I wrote called Shakespeare's Itches, and there's an asterisk in front of itches, so you can, there's a truncation symbol where you can replace that letter with B or W or GL, so it's, you know, Shakespeare's Bitches, Witches, Glitches. It's a series of songs that I have written and continue to write from the points of view of Shakespeare's women, especially the ones that I feel didn't get full voice in his plays. And Ernest Wiggins and Don Fast and I opened the show on Shakespeare's 450th birthday last year at the Oradell Public Library, and so right now that's in process right now. What's next is to broaden the scope of where I perform this show. It's a one woman show. And I'm taking vocal lessons from a wonderful opera singer, Shana Timofeeva, and guitar lessons because I do accompany myself in the show. So right now it's this musical, the Shakespeare musical, that is very much in the forefront for me. I do have a lot of catching up because I did not publish poems for you know, for the first 20 years of my writing. So I am going to be, I'm looking for venues for None Flying Through Walls. That's my Hungarian poems. The Ashes, Ashes, the is that series of Holocaust poems I wrote, and artist Joe Jochnowitz and I toured that through the New Jersey State School of the Arts to high schools and galleries. And we're actually having an opening, and what we're doing is we're putting his charcoal drawings in response to the Holocaust as an installation with my poems on 17 and by 11 that are paired with these drawings in the Howe Gallery at Kane University. We're actually opening on November 4th, and we're going to have a panel discussion, and I'll be reciting some of my poems on November 21st. So that's a really big upcoming thing that I'm looking very much forward to. It's important. It's important work of witnessing and remembrance. And I feel that there's a lot of amazing work being done in Holocaust education, especially in this state where we have a committed, educational agenda for Holocaust education. My part is to embody these different characters from whose points of view I've written these poems, and I find that it gives students, especially, another dimension, an emotional embodied dimension, to help them to really to get that this happened to somebody that could be happening right now. So a great deal of immediacy comes through in these first person poems. So the next is, you know, there's a couple of things on, a couple of fires on, brands in the fire.
Would you like to either do another poem for us, or if you have enough confidence in your singing, to give us one of your songs?
Well, I could sing part of a song. This is from Isabella's point of view, from Measure for Measure, and she is just entering the Convent of St. Clair's, which is the parallel order for women from St. Francis. And as we all know, St. Francis is, he found the divine in his connection with nature. And so I give Isabella this love of nature as well in this poem. What happens in the play, we don't have to know very much about Shakespeare to appreciate this song, but I like to give a little background. She is being the Vice Duke is trying to Angelo is trying to seduce her, and he says, "I will save your brother from sure death if you will bed with me." And so she, of course, doesn't want to do this. Her chastity is an important part of her devotions. And so this is a song that she sings. I'm enough, I'm enough, I'm enough as I am. I'm enough, I'm enough, I'm enough for them. I'm enough for the trees they want to shade me with their leaves. I'm enough for the air, it waits for my inhale. I'm enough for the skies, it shines me suns and moons and stars. I'm enough for the sea, spreading ruffly skirts for me. So that's the chorus and first refrain.
I'm afraid that the acoustics of the radio show didn't do you justice. I hope it comes out well.
I hope so too. Well, we do have a CD if people want it, but it's, and also I'm accompanied, and I wasn't quite warmed up, but it's a song that I find and very soon the audience sings it along, and people, it's in the anthem, and people use it a lot for to build themselves up. It's good for kids, you know. I'm enough, I'm enough, I'm enough. I mean, you know, as a Hungarian, I've spent much of my life feeling like I'm not enough. That's probably what I'm doing too much in my life right now. But so this song is very important for me as a person.
We've touched a lot the bases. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
Well, I'm really grateful for this opportunity to be able to talk about what I do and what I've done and what my devotions are. You know, it sometimes takes a generous interviewer, as you are, John. You know, to be able to feel more whole and to realize that really I'm okay and I'm enough. So, you know, it's. You know, we've talked a lot about different things that I've done, but I think what's more important ultimately is what poetry does for us all. And, you know, I tell this to my writing poetry students, that it's not so much the actual poem, though that's important and that's good and that's great, but who I become in the process of being a poet, of being a songwriter, of being someone who performs, someone who teaches. Who have I become? And all the achievements are like shells that fall off the person who emerges from all of that work. You know, the unpeeling. For me, it's a constant process of trying to be more authentic, to not feel so worried about what other people think of me, but to, you know, to care about what connects me to others. And so that's what I want people to know, that's my devotion. I want to be more authentic. I want to be more loving. And for example, with my students and my senior writing students who are working on projects, that's what we're working on. I said, let's make sure that what we write is authentic, something that means something to us. And, you know, I'm very, very lucky being at Kane University. I've learned a lot. I have great colleagues, and I have immensely amazing students. And we were talking about immigrants before, and I have three different students in this class who are writing from the immigrant experience. You know, one of them is a young girl who's writing from, you know, how she had to escape Albania, and she was in a truck and, you know, trying to go across the border, and they had to make sure there were enough boxes around them so that the detectors that detect heartbeats, you know, didn't pick up that there were people in the truck. And, you know, my Colombian student, you know, writing about, you know, how hard it is for her parents to talk about immigration. So, you know, authenticity. I want people to know that I appreciate the example of all my poet friends and all my artist friends, and then that's what's most important.
I can see that with your writing. I know that I write poetry for myself, but that must be difficult with your performance because you really want the audience to appreciate it, to get something out of it. So you have to be interested in how they're judging you, don't you?
Well, what I have found most gratifying is when after the performance, people come up to me and say, "Oh my God, I mean, I heard you talking about your experience, and it reminded me of what happened with my mother. And I think I'm going to write about it. You know, thank you so much." I mean, people call me fearless. It's just that I don't know any better. I start something, and by the time I'm in it, you know, I'm in it. But and that's what matters to me. So that the more, again, it's the same thing as in a classroom. The audience learns who I am, not necessarily what I'm saying. And so if I'm being authentic, if I'm talking from an authentic voice, and I'm immensely interested in my audiences, that's why I like to recite my poems and put them together in shows. There's eye contact. I am fed by the emotions that I see in my audience. So we are not separate. We, you know, judging usually happens, you know, or approval happens when we are separate. For me, it's a process in my classroom, in my writing, in my performances, to establish an intimacy so I'm not really being fearless. I really feel like I'm together with other people who have the similar human things going on, and so I don't feel separate from them. And if somebody, you know, is into like a blame game or a judgment game or a competition game, I understand that. I partake in that too when I'm in my less good moments. But you know, I just try to remember the people who are touched, who do grow, and I take my nourishment from that. You know, it's it's not like I've always had this. Do you know? You know, I've been caught up in the whole, you know, competition POBIS thing, and it just backfires.
Publish or perish, as they call the academic world, right?
Well, I did get caught up in it because of that, but you know, it's okay. Every day is new. And you know, it's always, you know, I'm sitting down at the desk and, you know, why am I writing? And I mean, that's how I talk to my writing students, and that's my main teaching is writing. You know, I say, well, what's authentic to you? And I work very hard on getting the power structures down. You know, so for example, I mean, I assign my students to write, you know, to do the media freeze, I have to do it too. If I assign my students to write three journal pages a day, I'm doing it too. You know, and then I see what the challenges are, and the benefits. So,
I get it. I get it.
Yeah, I know you do. I know you do, John. You do such amazing work. You know, on your website. I mean, you know, it's a great devotion, and you're so very supportive of all of your colleagues, and you know, that's what it's all about, to know that we're all in this together, and we do the best we can.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for those words and for this evening. It's been a real pleasure.
For me too, John. Thank you so very much.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, if the Mets win, which we hope they do tonight, put it in the book. tune in next week, and as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady still was said it.
See ya.
We'll be right back.